the wind wagon tacked into increasingly strong winds as the storm approached from the northeast. Ragged banners of clouds raced white beneath the low, gray ceiling of storm front. Grasses whipped and bent under gusts of cold wind. Ripples of lightning illuminated the horizon and were followed by rolls of thunder sounding like warning shots across the wind wagon's bow. The pilgrims watched in silence until the first icy raindrops drove them below to the large stateroom in the stern.
"This was in his robe pocket,"
said Braun Lamia, holding up a slip of paper with the number 5 on it.
"So Mastine would have told his story next,"
muttered the consul. Martin Silenus tilted his chair until his back touched the tall windows. Stormlight made his satyr's features appear slightly demonic.
"There's another possibility. Perhaps someone who hasn't spoken yet had the fifth spot and killed the Templar to trade places."
Lamia stared at the poet.
"That would have to be the consul or me,"
she said, her voice flat. Silenus shrugged. Braun Lamia pulled another piece of paper from her tunic.
"I have number 6. What would I have achieved? I go next anyway."
"Then perhaps it's what Mastine would have said that needed to be silenced,"
said the poet. He shrugged again.
"Personally, I think the Shrike has begun harvesting us. Why did we think we'd be allowed to get to the tombs when the thing's been slaughtering people halfway from here to Keats?"
"This is different,"
said Saul Weintraub.
"This is the Shrike pilgrimage."
"So?"
In the silence that followed, the consul walked to the windows. Wind-driven torrents of rain obscured the sea and rattled the leaded panes. The wagon creaked and leaned heavily to starboard as it began another leg of its tack.
"M. Lamia, do you want to tell your story now?"
Lamia folded her arms and looked at the rain-streaked glass.
"No. Let's wait until we get off this damned ship. It stinks of death."
The wind wagon reached the port of Pilgrim's Rest in mid-afternoon, but the storm and tired light made it feel like late evening to the weary passengers. The consul had expected representatives from the Shrike Temple to meet them here at the beginning of the penultimate stage of their journey. But Pilgrim's Rest appeared to the consul to be as empty as Edge had been. The approach to the foothills and the first sight of the Bridal Range was as exciting as any landfall, and brought all 6 of the would-be pilgrims on deck, despite the cold rain which continued to fall. The foothills were sere and sensuous, their brown curves and sudden upthrustings contrasting strongly with the verdant monochrome of the sea of grass. The 9,000-meter peaks beyond were only hinted at by gray and white plains, soon intersected by low clouds. But even so truncated were powerful to behold. The snow line came down to a point just above the collection of burned-out hovels and cheap hotels which had been Pilgrim's Rest.
"If they destroyed the tramway, we're finished,"
muttered the consul. The thought of it, forbidden until now, made his stomach turn over.
"I see the first 5 towers,"
said Colonel Cassad, using his powered glasses.
"They seem intact."
"Any sign of a car?"
"No. Wait, yes. There's one in the gate at the station platform."
"Any moving?"
asked Martin Silenus, who obviously understood how desperate their situation would be if the tramway was not intact.
"No."
The consul shook his head. Even in the worst weather with no passengers, the cars had been kept moving to keep the great cables flexed and free of ice. The 6 of them had their luggage on deck even before the wind wagon reefed its sails and extended a gangplank. Each now wore a heavy coat against the elements, Cassad in force-issue thermoflage cape, Braun Lamia in a long garment called a trench coat for reasons long forgotten, Martin Silenus in thick furs, which rippled now sable, now gray, with the vagaries of wind. Father Hoyt in long black, which made him more of a scarecrow figure than ever. Saul Weintraub in a thick goose-down jacket, which covered him and the child. And the consul, in the thinning but serviceable greatcoat his wife had given him some decades before.
"What about Captain Mastine's things?"
asked Saul as they stood at the head of the gangplank. Cassatt had gone ahead to reconnoiter the village.
"I brought them up. We'll take them with us."
"It doesn't seem right somehow. Just going on, I mean. There should be some service, some recognition that a man has died."
"May have died,"
reminded Lamia, easily lifting a 40-kilo backpack with one hand. Hoyt looked incredulous. "Do you really believe that M. Mastine might be alive?"
"No,"
said Lamia. Snowflakes settled on her black hair.